how could you ever tell when somebody was going to plan something in which he didn't give you any advance notice, such as this thing you just described? And it all came back to, and the third element was the one that we talked about in another context, of being able to have a relationship with community or everyone else, so that you were, if a crisis arose, there was an understanding, a basic understanding, that you know that, in other words, they had to trust you. I went through this with Buffalo. I had a terrible, terrible night with the whole Buffalo delegation here in Albany at the Capitol one night. Started at 8 o'clock at night and lasted until almost 2 in the morning. They weren't going to let me out of there until they had 23 demands that they could imagine. They were the ones that demanded, not the students. At 23 demands, and they said they weren't going to let me out of that room until I gave in on every single one of them. And when we left at almost 2, I had given one of the 23. And finally, one of them said, look, he said, I know this man, and I trust him. And if he says he's going to do these things, I believe him. And I'm not going to sit around here any longer and push these things. Now, I never had the reason we didn't have that was we had a mess in Buffalo. Myerson had gone off to do some, first he went off for a year or two without even telling me ahead of time that he was planning to do this. He went off and went to some American assembly or something to do a piece of research. Then when he came back, he got himself a job at the university, as head of the University of Pennsylvania. And there was so much politics going on in terms of who was going to be the next president. There were the ones who wanted this fellow, Ketter. Remember Ketter? Who was not the right man. And they just didn't have the leadership. The vice presidents were struggling with each other. This was when Warren Bennis was there, and Pete, who was a psychiatrist by trade. My point is that every time you deviated from that policy of allowing police to come on the campus, certainly you never invited them to come. If they came in some other way, then you had to face it. But that saved us all kinds of trouble, because a lot of them, their first thought was to run to the police, you know.
Well, I think,
but I don't remember much.
I think Johnny handled it well. I think we had good relations with the district attorney.
My recollection is that there was some one person who was trying to make political capital out of this. Is that true?
I think there's probably more than one.
Oh.
In the Republican. But I remember I testified, and Johnny testified. And the whole thing blew over as far as the district attorney was concerned. In other words, there was no no reason for putting any of the administration in jeopardy. It certainly gave it national publicity.
Well, this was a tough part. The only thing that saved it for the university was that everybody else was getting it too. We actually had a handful of hot spots. I had a lot of trouble at we had one place which was sort of a drop-off place for drugs on the thruway.
Newpaw?
Newpaw. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of trouble with Newpaw. Mm-hmm. And the police were always watching. And then I had a terrible time keeping the police off that campus. Because mm-hmm. they knew that there were drugs being dropped off there. Mm-hmm. And there again, there was always a question of the leadership on that campus. The man who was president then hadn't been there very long. But he seemed to be sort of bemused by the whole thing. He just didn't understand that there was anything that could be done. We had a couple of go-arounds in Albany, as I recall. And some of them were a little startling. The ones who had the real trouble in New York were Tim Perkins up at Cornell. He ran into a bus stop up there. And it was his own fault. He never used to stick around.
Well, now let's see. The Health Sciences Center at Ed Pellegrino.
Oh, yes.
You wanted
well, Ed, I really worked on that one, and I continued to hold Ed. You don't know how many times I had to hold Ed Pellegrino's hand. He would come to me periodically ready to go somewhere else. He was a fast-moving fella, you know.
Yeah.
Still is, I guess.
I think he finally found his niche. An endowed chair, Kennedy Center for Ethics at Georgetown.
I think that's where he is now. But he was at a Catholic university for a while. I'm trying to think of where he was when I met him. Where was he just before he came to Stony Brook? He was at Yale, wasn't he?
That was after.
Oh, it was after. But where was he?
Hunterdon comes into my mind in New Jersey. Possibly Tennessee, I don't know.
May have been Tennessee. Tennessee sounds more like it. I can't remember now where I heard of it. But I heard things about him that made me feel that he was a man that could do the job that we needed to have done. And I don't recall how our first arrangement to meet turned out. But I remember we met, and I decided very soon thereafter that he was the man for the job. The problem was not whether he was the man, but whether we could get him to come, because he had offers, but he was really a hot item, as they say. And we had dinner together in New York City at the Century Club, and I really went out of my way to make sure that he realized that we wanted him. And finally, and when he came with a pretty fixed idea of what he wanted to see happen in terms of that health center. The thing that I liked most about him was his ideas of using the hospitals in the community to interface with whatever was being done on the teaching side in the school, so that you didn't have to have big establishments all over the state. You could do this thing in a much more controlled sort of way. And as he'd explained it to me, it seemed like a reasonable and proper way to do things. And I guess, as it turned out, he did a good job. He always left a job because he had some new cloud he wanted to reach up to. I guess you're right, he went to Yale. But he used to come to me periodically after he got settled at Stony Brook. He would come, I always knew when he called me that what was the topic of our conversation was going to be. I would come into New York City, and we would meet, sometimes have dinner, but we would meet, and he had an office. And I, after the first couple of times, I simply said to him, Ed, I'm not going to sit here and match offers that you get. I said, it's impossible for me. I said, you're going to keep on getting lots of offers. I said, we want you. We love the things you're doing. We're absolutely sure that they're right, and we will back you in every way we can. I said, now, if that isn't enough, if we can't supply the things that you feel you have to have, then I'm sorry. And he was very nice about it. You know, he never went into a tantrum about anything. He just presented his case. And ultimately, he decided he wanted to do something else. I don't think it had much to do with the fact that he didn't get everything he wanted at Stony Brook. I think he got most of what he wanted.
I think there was a little friction between him and Johnny.
Well, that may be. I think Johnny may have thought that he was really out to become the president of Stony Brook. That might have been. I don't know. But as far as my relationship with him was concerned, we were, and later I saw him a number of times. In fact, I asked him to join a commission once, which he did, that I was working on. But he was all over the place, as you know.
Yeah.
I often wondered how in the world, he had about 6-7 children, didn't he? He had a big family.
Six
children. Often wondered how he kept moving them around from place to place the way he did.
His wife, Clem, was a little dynamo in her own right.
She was.
Well organized.
Well, he was a very nice man, and I liked him tremendously and appreciated what he did at a time when we really needed it. These health centers in a university are a tremendous headache. I don't know how the private institutions manage to keep their ones that they have going. I think things of that kind have to be supported by public funds. There's just never enough otherwise. And the drain on here, this Memorial Hospital we have here in the city of Sarasota, we have two hospitals. One is a county hospital, really is under the county. The other is a private hospital. And Memorial Hospital can use up more money in a week than you think is possibly be used in half a year.
I'm on the board of Mather Hospital in Port Jefferson. I've been in the black almost every quarter.
But of course the charges that they have to make are just phenomenal. We've had a few experiences, and when I see the bills, it's enough to make you cringe. And I don't know. I don't know enough about the inner workings of it to know whether there's something wrong or whether it's all the way it has to be, but it's not good. We need a different system in this country.
I think the frontier of the hardware in the medical field is moving ahead so rapidly, and the research in it is so expensive that the price of the early results, the early units, is so high that hospitals that wish to be offering the latest in
they sock it to the patients, you see.
Yeah.
I mean, well, my doctor has been very frank with me about, for instance, they have these things like CAT scan, the other, none of the other, God knows what to buy. He said, look, he said, we prescribed their use because we got to get the damn thing paid for. Well, okay, maybe. Right. Well, that's not so good for the patient.
Well, let's see. Stony Brook's balance is between science, social sciences, humanities, engineering, marine sciences, health sciences. Some feel that the leadership has been by scientists, by and large, and that the humanities have suffered. Now, our Fine Arts Center finally came, but we had to wait a long time for that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not familiar with the present situation, so I can't answer the question too much about what the existing balance is and whether it's good or bad. But I know that when we started, there was a definite idea that although all these areas had to be dealt with and had to be developed on campus
in a comprehensive
the emphasis was going to be on science. That was going to be the place where the biggest investment would be made in certain of the sciences. And I think that's how it has turned out. In contrast to that, at Binghamton, we did not want to make that kind of investment in the sciences there. And that probably has seemed much less of an expense because in the liberal arts, you don't have to acquire all these kinds of equipment that are so necessary in the other.
Yeah, the library.
I think in general, the four centers have developed their own distinctive characteristics, where there are certain emphases that make the place stand out. I don't think any campus, and I don't think any university can do everything. In the University of California, the problem that I found there was that Berkeley wanted to be all things to all people and didn't want anybody else to do anything. If any really good idea came along, Berkeley was there to grab it. That was a little tough to take sometimes. Whereas the rivalry between Berkeley and UCLA was almost as though they were two separate institutions. Now, UCLA has developed tremendously. It's much different as a campus from what you find at Berkeley, even though Berkeley is the granddaddy of the whole thing. There are distinctive characteristics to those campuses, and there are strengths to be found on each campus, which are terribly important. Davis is a perfect example of that in California, where the strength has been in the agricultural area and in the wine industry. What the whole California wine industry owes, whatever it is, to the Davis campus of the University of California. They've done a fantastic job there. Well, here in New York, it's the same kind of thing. I think that the Albany campus, with its emphasis on the relationship between government and community life and so on, has that as its major force. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have the arts and all the humanities and so on, but the emphasis is there. Binghamton, we know where the emphasis is. Buffalo is much more the professional kind of campus, where they got a medical, they have a health center and a law school
they have a
whole variety of things, some of them which we inherited, a few which have been started since. I think that is healthy. And whether you can maintain that balance constantly exactly the way you want it is quite another matter. You bring faculty in the liberal arts to a campus like Stony Brook, and you can't very well say to them that you're not as important as the scientist or the tremendous emphasis, but they feel it. They're bound to. Yet, without their being there, and this is the point that isn't made often enough, without their being there, the sciences would suffer terribly. MIT has tried, I don't know how many times, to develop a humanistic quality in its approach to what it does. It has its reputation in the sciences. I remember when they put in a whole liberal arts program. Well, I think the faculty did more to kind of kick it in the teeth than anybody else did. They're doing it again. They've been doing it again. I think they will continue to do it, and they must do it. Otherwise, we're going to develop a group of students, a group of graduates, who are terribly out of balance with what's going on. Our business schools are the perfect example of what not to do in education. If you examine what the major business schools have been doing
at the undergraduate level,
and at the graduate level, I'm particularly perturbed about the ones in the graduate level. They turn out these men and women who don't have any idea except how to get out there and make as much money as they can as fast as they can make it. It's a what's in it for me philosophy. And when you begin to talk about public service, the same thing's true at the law school. You find a lot of schools devoted to public service. It's a rarity. This means that how to get the liberal arts people who are on campuses like that to understand the value of what they're doing, even though they're not center stage in all of this, is a very, very hard nut to crack.
At Stony Brook now, the humanities are scattered. The English department is in the old red brick building that was called the humanities building back in the early 60s. The languages are in the library. The library's going to need that space at some point. Philosophy is in the old physics building. Religion is just moving from the old physics building to the old chemistry building. And,
is there no way to consolidate this in a little better way?
Well, there ought to be. But if you are going to bring them together, and bring them together at a point within a reasonable distance of the main library, the way the campus is now, you're going to have to go up.
I see.
There's not the room to...
Who's the president down there now?
Jack Marburger.
Oh, yeah.
He came from USC.
Yeah, it's Carl Marburger, his brother?
I have no idea.
Carl Marburger was the commissioner of education in New Jersey, as I recall.
His family is in Maryland.
There must be a different one.
Anyway, that's one of the pieces of unfinished business, I think. You've got to bring the humanities together within reasonable distance of the library.
Well, you've either got to do that, or you've got to have some satellite libraries around the campus.
Well, the sciences have satellite libraries. Social sciences,
you may find, I don't know, because I haven't seen the place for years and years. You may find, however, with the limitations of space that you have, that rather than build a building for the humanities and put them all together, and that has certain dangers in it too, you know. The idea of if the library is the problem, you can have satellite libraries in almost anywhere. And it's not such a bad idea sometimes. The thing I worry about when you put certain disciplines all together, I watched this when we were building in Santa Barbara, is that a certain inbreeding develops where they pretty soon they don't have anything to do with one another. science group, for example, they had a science building in Santa Barbara, and the chemists and the biologists and the this and that, they all had offices in this building. Come lunchtime, they all brought their little brown bags, and they sat together in their own little cubbyholes. You know, they didn't have one having to do with anybody else. They certainly would have nothing to do with anybody from the humanities. I tried to
break that down.
I don't know what happens now there. I tried to break it down by developing a faculty club where they could go and have lunch. I even had to offer to pay for their lunches in order to get them to go over there to have lunch, because they just didn't want to be associated with those long-haired guys from the English department or the whatnot. I don't know how, it wasn't broken down properly by the time I left. I know they have an excellent faculty club there now, and I should presume they've taken care
of it. We have one on the drawing boards now.
Well, I think the faculty club is a excellent component to use to draw faculty of different disciplines together. It's going to take the right kind of directorship of such a club and the right kind of faculty committee to work on a problem like that. But it's amazing how they will avoid one another if they possibly can.